Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2013 documentary film Running From Crazy, directed by Barbara Koppel. This program, presented in collaboration with the Kim Foundation, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, October 7th, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The members of the panel will be Howard Liu, an educator and child psychiatrist at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and director of faculty development programs at UNMC, Mindy Eggert, the mother of Cameron Molitor, lost to suicide 2 years ago, and Ciara Warden, a licensed independent social worker in the state of Iowa and a full-time faculty member at the University of Nebraska at Omaha's School of Social Work. Running From Crazy is a documentary examining the personal journey of model and actress Mariel Hemingway, the granddaughter of Ernest Hemingway, as she strives for a greater understanding of her family history of suicide and mental illness. Through stunning archival footage of the three Hemingway sisters and intimate verite moments with Mariel herself, the film examines the remarkable, though often heartbreaking, Hemingway legacy. As Mariel comes to terms with the tragedies of her family's past that have shaped the course of her life, deeply hidden secrets are revealed and truths emerge. Through it all, Mariel finds a way to overcome a similar fate for herself and her daughters, brings awareness to an issue about which she is deeply passionate, and discovers an inner strength and peace. Here now to introduce the program is Julia Hebenstreit, Executive Director of the Kim Foundation. The discussion will be introduced by our moderator, Erin Grace, a columnist with the Omaha World Herald.
The Kim Foundation, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, it's a family foundation focused on mental health. Our mission is to be a supportive resource and compassionate voice for lives touched by mental illness. And so we do a lot of public awareness work, advocacy work, and connecting folks with resources throughout the community. So thanks, everyone, for coming.
Thanks, everybody, for coming tonight. I think that was a pretty moving film that we just watched, and so I'm grateful to be here tonight with a wonderful panel that you'll hear from in just a few minutes. I think what I'll do is just read a little blurb about each of you by way of introduction. We don't have a whole lot of time, and I think what we'll do is we'll just go down the line and have them talk to you for a few minutes, but then try to spend most of our time on the questions. And so luckily for us, this is going to be recorded. So I guess I need to stress we need to speak into the microphone if you are going to be speaking. So again, thank you for joining us and for being at one of Omaha's Treasures Film Streams. Okay, so I want to start out and introduce to my right is Ms. Ciara Warden. Ciara is a licensed independent social worker in the state of Iowa and a full-time faculty member at the University of Nebraska at Omaha School of Social Work. Before becoming a mental health practitioner, Ciara struggled immensely with depression and is a self-proclaimed suicide attempt survivor. It is now Ciara's life purpose to share her story of hope and continue to educate people about the complicated issue of suicide, which is often surrounded by stigma. And I think you can all appreciate how tough it must be to be in her shoes. We're so glad that she can be here tonight. Next up, we have Dr. Howard Liu. He's an educator and child psychiatrist at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. He serves as the director of faculty development programs at UNMC, overseeing career development programs in medicine, nursing, pharmacy, public health, dentistry, and allied health. He also serves as the director of the Behavioral Health Education Center of Nebraska, a state-funded office charged with the recruitment, retention, and training of behavioral health providers across Nebraska. Clinically, Dr. Liu has expertise in pediatric mood disorders and maintains a child psychiatry outpatient practice. And last but not least, we have Mindy Eggert. Mindy is a mother of 20-year-old Cameron Molitor, lost to suicide on December 18, 2012. While she has had her own struggle with depression for years, it doesn't begin to compare with the heightened awareness Mindy and her family have experienced through this loss. She prays that the pain that she and her family have experienced will help them to be vessels through which someone else may become educated enough to have their own pain lightened or, better yet, eliminated. And I think it's fair to say, Mindy, you're our Mariel Hemingway tonight, who can talk to us personally. And I just want to add that before we were coming tonight, I looked up your son and our clips, and there's this wonderful photo of him as a child with Laura Bush when she was First Lady. She was visiting, and he was a little boy sitting right by her. So thank you all for joining us. I think we'll go down the line, and we'll just start with Sierra. And Sierra, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you. As you stated, and it's Grace?
Yeah,
Grace.
Or okay. Aaron. Call me anything.
Okay, Aaron Grace. As you stated, I am a self-proclaimed suicide survivor. I obviously went into this profession for that very reason. I struggled immensely with depression throughout. Since I can remember, it really resonated with me in the film when she said, "You've always known a little bit about being sad." That really hit home. So when she said that, it really brought back my ongoing struggle throughout my entire life. I had a very serious attempt when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and I somehow survived it, and I wasn't supposed to, and that was kind of my wake-up call. From there on out, I took on the treatment, and I did medication, I did the therapy, I was finally cooperative, and I started to look within myself by helping others, and then I went into the field of social work, of course, and so now I am teaching other social worker minds and hopefully making them better social workers, and using my personal experience to connect with clients, with students, and to talk about this issue. That is my biggest thing, is a lot of people don't talk about this issue. We mention mental health issues and problems, and we want to address them, but suicide is something that's definitely overlooked and stigmatized, and almost everyone I can think of has somehow been impacted by suicide. So I'm really, really honored to be a part of this panel and talk about this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'm also very honored to be part of this discussion, and I'm actually quite interested to hear stories from the audience as well, and what you guys have been through and why you're here tonight. You know, I represent the Behavioral Health Education Center in Nebraska, and our job is to try to find folks that are going to be passionate about going into the field, like Sierra, sometimes with lived experience, and sometimes just because they're drawn to it. And you know, one of the challenges for our state is that there are so few providers, and a lot of folks have to wait so long to get in to see a therapist or a psychiatrist or somebody like that. And a lot of that, I think, is because of, I was thinking about this movie, and I thought it was quite moving. One of the final scenes where they're looking at the room where Ernest Hemingway took his life, and she said, "Well, you know, as a child, I always avoided going into this room," made me think that how many of us live that way, you know, when we have this closet, this area, this dark space, it's a loved one, a colleague, that we walk away from it. And I see students, you know, as they're thinking about careers, whether they're in medical school or nursing school, sometimes walk away from that dark space because they don't know, you know, that the healing is possible. And I think events like this are so important to talk to families, talk to providers, and talk to our community to really find, you know, what happens in that space and how can we transform it. And so I'm, you know, and I've traveled around the state of Nebraska and really found that there are a lot of really passionate people that are, I think, going to be our next generation of folks in the therapist chair or the psychiatrist desk. And it's just been an honor to be here, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions about suicide and things from the provider standpoint. But thank you very much.
I guess the biggest thing that I can say is that while I come from the non-educational aspect of it, I come from the real-life aspect of suicide, and while Sierra has lived in it as well, if you've ever talked to somebody or opened that doorway to talking to somebody about suicide, about mental health. We all have mental health, whether it's good or bad or whatever. You have a mental health, and we need to do more about educating people about their own mental health and about the health of their family and friends to keep them going and keep them learning more and talking. If you don't talk about it, nobody's going to know. And if you don't know, then you're just going to stay in that painful, dark place. So my son said something once to me shortly between his first attempt, because it was 3 months before his final attempt that he had initially made an attempt. And he said to me, "Mom, I used to think some mental health was something that was, or that depression was just something in your head that you just had to get over." He said, "I never realized that it was real." Well, he found out how real it was, and it haunted him, and the pain that he endured is a pain now that we all endure even more deeply and in a different way, but still something that we all need to be able to learn to help friends, family, and everyone learn to get past, get through it day by day, minute by minute, just like we do. It's almost 2 years later, but, and I know people that have been on this journey a lot longer than we have, and it's still a battle day by day, minute by minute, second by second. That thought comes, that you see whatever to remind you of that place, that child, that parent, that sibling, that friend. If you don't talk, we're never going to get past the stigma. The stigma, the groundwork that so many people have talked about how sinful it is and everything else. All that needs to be erased. We can't erase the memories, but we can erase the stigma.
I wonder, Mindy, if we could start with you. A question that came to mind in light of tonight's film is how did your family cope in the aftermath of this event? What has helped? And so often, friends and family don't know what to say. So I think we all err on the side of saying nothing. What can you tell us about what helped your family so far, and what advice would you give others who are trying to help?
On the initial onset of getting help, we were very thankful and fortunate to be a part of a church family that has held us up continuously, not only in prayer but in support. They're the ones who fed us for days and days and lifted us up and helped us do the normal things. And I've said time and again, I don't know where we'd have been without those people. For people that don't have that, my heart goes out to them and to you if you're one of them, because it is something that if you don't have a network of somebody supporting you and asking you, checking on you. I still have friends regularly asking me, "How am I doing?" They know all the significant dates. They know that, you know, Tuesdays are bad and Thursdays are bad and you know, whatever. They know those things. I think one of the things that helped me personally, and I think it threw a lot of people off, is I bring it up. I'm not ashamed of it. It's a part of my life. He was a part of my life. He is a part of my life, and he will always be a part of our life. And so we continually mention him, talk about him. We are working. I have four older siblings, half-brother and sisters, and those are the ones I really worry about the most, because they don't talk. They don't, you know, my oldest son says, "I'm sorry to bring up a bad thing, Mom," and I'm like, "No, it's not a bad thing. He's your brother. We talk about him as much as you want, and don't ever stop." One of the things that I did for some of my coworkers after going back, because we had happened to be on our winter break when this all occurred, and I had found online a resource that actually gave me some steps or things for them to say and do and things that would help them help me. And I made copies of it and passed it out to my coworkers and said, "I don't know if you're interested in this or not. If this makes you uncomfortable, I'm sorry. but here's something that I just thought I'd like to share with you. And it really did help them for me to open that door and get them talking and be able to.
And so on that note, Sierra, what did you, well, first off, I'm curious, how old are you?
How old do you think I am?
Younger than me. I am 28 years old. So you're not that far removed in years from the time of your struggle. How did you pull, what pulled you out of that? What made a difference for you so that you can be here today? And thank God you are. We're glad you're here.
Thanks. I think what happened was I kind of had my own personal spiritual awakening in a psychiatrist's office. I was on behavior health unit right after I was in ICU. You know, that's the whole protocol when you try to kill yourself. And I was angry that I was alive. That's how sick I was. I remember waking up crying. I was so angry. And then I was sitting with a psychiatrist who had been practicing for over 30 years, and he just looked at me and he goes, you know, I've been practicing a really long time. And he goes, there's no reason why you should be sitting across from me right now. And I just kind of looked at him. He goes, I've never seen toxicity levels like that in someone who's alive. And I was like, okay, you know, I was angsty and all of that, and depressed. And so what do you mean by that? You know, what's your point, doc? And he says, well, what do you think that means? And it just resonated with me. And I didn't know what that meant, but it meant something. And he goes, there's a reason why you're here. He goes, I don't know what it is. He goes, but I, in my 30 years of practice, I've never seen someone alive with those levels. So when he said that to me, I guess I kind of shook awake a little bit. It wasn't immediate. It wasn't like I frolicked out of the office and felt better and was magically not depressed anymore. It took a lot of work. It took a lot of practice. It took a lot of talking about what I was going through. And took many years to be okay to talk about this. Going into the profession I went into and being a mental health practitioner, helping other people help themselves, I had to get well before I could do that. And I have to be really careful about what I self-disclose. This is the first time I've really talked about what has happened to me in an open forum. People close to me know, but sharing this with a community in what I do, a lot of people still with that stigma attached. Oh gosh, is she going to go off the deep end sometime? She's responsible for clients. It took a lot of work, but I think it was that day that a seasoned psychiatrist just said, "Wake up, you're here. Do something about it."
Dr. Liu, one of the things I was wondering watching the film, and this will be my last question, everybody, if you guys want to pipe up. So I guess this is my cue to start thinking about questions. It was the idea of, you know, the whole theme of the film, running from crazy. She's afraid of a genetic connection. She's afraid that this is going to be destiny, not something she can avoid. Can you speak to that issue of...
Yeah, you know, it's difficult, and I would say there's no easy answers. You know, when you look at any family history of whether it's diabetes or heart disease, things like that, and I think there was a time when we used to think it was sort of one gene, you know, one illness, and that if you could just figure that one, you know, figure out how to solve that one puzzle, things would be better. But we realize now that it's much more complex, and there are many things that interact between, in our family history and what happens to us, and whether that thing is, you know, trauma, you know, whether that's you're serving in Iraq and, you know, an IED explodes and there are four people in that car, you know, but why is it that you are the one that has recurrent nightmares? Or, you know, five of you are in school, you know, and many of you are struggling academically, but why is it that you're the one that's a little bit more vulnerable? And we think there is interaction, and we certainly do know that there is family history of things that puts you at greater risk. But we also do know that it's not, you know, like it's fully determined as well. It's not that simple. And so, you know, what Sierra's story is, you know, I think is illustrates is that, you know, there is still some will piece of it. There's still some family and some spiritual elements, as Mindy's have mentioned, and I think it's going to be that complex dynamic. And finally, you know, as Sarah said, it takes some compassionate care from providers as well, and sometimes this challenge is between what the family and loved ones can hold and when to seek help, and crossing that line is also a very difficult decision as well. But yeah,
thank you. Does anyone have a question for any of our panelists?
I'm just curious. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you. I'm just curious. I attempted suicide in 2003. Tried to drive off an embankment and was almost told I would never walk again. And I walk fine. I've had an ankle replacement in 2012. But the question I have is that I know there is the field of peer support specialists, and I'm a little curious about it because I've been, you know, I'm aware of it and have considered it as an option. I'm wondering, I hear that it's just kind of almost exploding, and they're in hospitals, but I know you have to be in, you know, amount of recovery and so forth, but I'm definitely interested in that. And I guess I'd point that to Dr. Liu.
This individual, what was your name again, sir?
My name's Fritz.
Fritz. So he's talking about peer support, and I think this is an area where I think it needs to explode, you know, frankly, because what you're talking about is someone that really has been through the experience of being, you know, right on the brink or being in recovery, but then being able to use that experience to help other people.
Right.
And I know there are several programs around the state that do actively engage peer support. Hospitals, they have so-called warm lines, warm help lines, where you can call if you're, you know, if you're struggling, and talk to someone that's been through depression, and certainly for day rehab and things like that, where you can have someone that's kind of been through that experience, and I think it's more powerful. One of the areas that we're trying to work at and look at is how do we make sure that the certification and the training leads to jobs.
Right. Yeah,
that's the next phase.
It like through Community Alliance, but I'm concerned, but I'm wondering, do they offer this through like UNL, or I mean, is it just a certification, or what exactly is it?
Well, there's a whole area, and basically. In healthcare, there's the so-called licensed workforce, right? Folks have been through degrees, psychology, psychiatry, psychiatric nurse practitioners, and so on. And then they're the great majority of the workforce who work as technicians, peer support, and so on. And they do invaluable work, and in fact, probably do much of the day-to-day interactions with folks as they're recovering. The challenge is, how do we make sure that they are then recognized, you know, and empowered? And certainly there is, to the Division of Behavioral Health, DHHS does have a division for consumer affairs, and Carol Cousins de Reyes is kind of the head of that piece, and she could probably comment much more eloquently than I on in terms of what they're doing for advocacy. But I guess my perspective is that it does need to grow. We need to recognize it as a licensed workforce, as an area that, you know, we can find ways. And for that, also, we need to find ways to reimburse that as well, such that these services are supported and are able to disseminate. So, and I don't know if either Sierra or Mindy have any thoughts on working with peers, and have you had any experience?
Well, what I know of is my professional experience in working with Heartland Family Service. I know that they have peer support specialists, and it's actually paid positions and all of that. It's a screening process, and you have to, like you said, you have to have so many years of recovery, and just like any other job, you would apply and share your story and then see how you would be beneficial to their client population. I know their ACT team is working with more of a persistent severe mental illness population. I don't know what exactly you struggle with personally, so it could be an option. I know in our community that they're really big advocates for peer peer support specialist, so something to look into.
We have another question way in the back.
I'm raising my 7-year-old niece, and her mom committed suicide. And I don't know when's the right time to tell her.
Wow, that's a real tough situation, Dr. Liu.
Yeah. Well,
big shoulders.
No, first of all, I'm very sorry to hear about your loss, and certainly there's no easy answers, and I would not presume to know, you know, your niece, and certainly hope that you're working with a therapist or a provider that you trust and have good rapport with. You know, it's interesting about kids and death and what they understand. On the flip side, they've actually done studies where children with terminal illnesses, you know, children that are dying from cancer or other things, and whether providers should tell them, you know, that they are dying, and when they've actually looked at this, the kids oftentimes do better than the adults with the knowledge, and in fact, as you know, as a father of three, I certainly know, kids are very good at reading their parents and their loved ones, and they know when something's happening, you know. So, you know, I wouldn't presume to give you a direct answer about your niece, but I would say that, you know, my advice would be to find someone that you trust, you know, a therapist, a counselor, a social worker, or so on. You know, introduce them to your loved one, and then raise this question with them, and as they get to know them over time, try to find when the right time is. And again, it's not going to be any formula, but you may be surprised in that oftentimes, you know, I found that kids are surprisingly wise and resilient, and can often handle more than we give them credit for. But again, it's a case by case basis, and I think it's also a process. It's not like you tell them once, you know, and it's very much akin to adoption. I think, you know, where you may understand it at one level when you're 7, again a different level when you're 12, and again a different level when you're 18, and so on. So I think just the knowledge that they can have this dialogue and this open door with you is going to be very important. I guess it's not a direct answer, but I think I would probably begin the process, particularly if the child is perceiving how you're dealing with it and how you are, you know, learning to cope with it yourself. So sometimes it helps them to have that as part of their understanding as well.
So. She was a year and a half when her mother shot herself. Mm-hmm. So she's turning 7, and she has been in therapy since I've had her, since that time. But it seems like when I get sick, she's afraid I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what an age-appropriate answer is either, to... you know, now she's starting to be more curious, like, how did it happen? Mm-hmm. And that's where it gets real scary.
Yeah. You know, I think it was Mr. Rogers that said, you know, play is the work of childhood. That, you know, oftentimes we have kids play and we think they're just kind of amusing themselves, but play really is a language. Play is the way they process things, whether it's a terrible thing that happened or a joyous thing. And you may have a sense, you know, as you're spending time with your niece, you know, what those themes are that are coming out, and being sensitive to some of those elements, you know. And, you know, again, I don't presume to know the exact right answer about, you know, how to do this. And I think it's always going to be delicate. But, you know, I think as you are engaging with your niece and sitting down with her and seeing kind of what things are coming out and as she's playing and talking and telling stories, it may give you a sense as to what the right timing is and what the direction might be. And I don't know, Sierra, if you have any thoughts as a therapist yourself, too.
That was brilliant.
I'm not a therapist or a professional, but I am a loving parent and person of our family, and I can tell you that if you trust in yourself and trust in what you know in your heart, you'll have the exact words at the right time.
I just wanted to make a comment that when my father passed away, that the hospice team that worked with him, they had a bereavement handout booklet that they gave all of the grandkids, you know, that were small, and then a photo album so that they could pick the pictures that they remembered, you know, or like to make a book for grandpa or whoever, you know, so they remember them to help them with their coping, you know, because you don't, it's amazing what they know at that age. I was, you know, I just, you know, you don't think they know at that little of an age, but they remember. And if they can see a picture, that would be helpful, you know. So.
And if you don't mind, I was just wondering, what was your sister's name?
My niece's name is Lena.
And what was her mother's name?
Diane.
Okay. You know, sometimes I like to hear people say their names.
Yeah, I didn't know if I should do that. Right.
You know, it's great because I feel like when we talk about suicide, we talk about them like they were here, like that. You know, it's like she died, she killed herself, you know, all of that. And sometimes it's very empowering to say your name. So I'm so sorry about Diane.
I'm a photographer, so I have lots and lots of photos with Lena and her mom.
Oh, wonderful.
And so we have pictures up all over. It's not a secret that Diane died. It's not a secret that she's gone. I take her to the cemetery. We reminisce, but I don't know how to tell her. She's going to say, how did it happen? So that's what I'm having trouble with. Yeah. You know, and there's going to be lots of questions like, well, didn't she love me, or she didn't want to be here? And so I'm hearing about all these dark places, and it's hindsight, but I see a lot of it now prior to it happening. And I was blindsided to it. And I wish I could just hit the rewind button.
You know, something that we encountered with Cameron was looking back on his pictures. And we actually, you're right, hindsight, because you do see there is a place oftentimes, and correct me if I'm wrong, doctors, but we saw junior high and high school is, I saw the smile, happy, carefree little boy that was meeting with Laura Bush. I saw his light fade. I saw him withdraw. I saw it after the fact. And it wasn't until we really analyzed all of that that it came to light. And it's just really something that you can acknowledge, and there's nothing wrong, I believe, in telling your niece that her mom was in pain, a pain that none of us can imagine.
Thank you for asking a question that I think applies no matter what the age is of someone. I don't think we have a language to talk about this. Certainly we don't talk about it very much. And it's a ginger topic for a lot of reasons, but I'm thankful that you asked that, and best of luck with as the process goes on.
My name's Evan Friemeyer. I'm a new teacher in Council Bluffs Public Schools. And I was just curious, because we encounter a lot of mental health issues in the classroom, but you don't have a lot of time and you have a lot of students. So I was wondering if you guys had any advice for how to maybe approach those sensitive issues and what you would advise a classroom teacher to do when it comes to depression or things connected to suicide.
Well, thanks for being a teacher. You're in the trenches. I'd really like, Dr. Liu, to address this, because sometimes we hear in the media about this so-called contagion effect. So I think how you deal with depression might be different than how you talk about suicide with teenagers in a classroom setting. What's your advice?
Yeah, well, again, I also applaud you, and I believe that teachers are really the front line, and parents are, and family members as well, and certainly, you know, I think it is something that's very common, and you know, whether it's something like ADHD, where you wonder, you know, is this child paying attention, and so on, to something serious like depression and suicidal thoughts and cutting, that kind of thing. I do think it's very important that, you know, teachers do communicate that with parents. Now, it's a delicate operation, and I know this because you know, one of the areas that we're focusing on our annual conference this year at Beacon is school-based mental health. And there are different models of it. There are some schools here in Omaha Public Schools, for example, where there is a health center in the school. And actually within the school there is a family nurse practitioner, you know. And if they have concerns, you know, people can refer to them and then they might be able to talk to a psychiatrist or so on. But I know that's a rarity and that's probably not the case for majority of schools. I would say that one thing you can do, and you're doing tonight, is, you know, getting a little bit more background, you know, on what's common, you know, and knowing kind of what's out there. But then I think being familiar with resources, one of the areas we're really trying to stretch ourselves, and something I realized early on, is that we're never going to have enough specialists. There's never going to be enough people like Sierra or people that are doing psychology, psychiatry, so on. So it's going to have to be some integration of, you know, different systems of care. The primary care increasingly is required now to screen for depression. You know, there's a screening called the PHQ, the Patient Health Questionnaire. So there are 2 questions or 9 questions. And so what you might encourage the parents to do is to go to their primary care doctor and then think about getting screened for depression, you know. And then at the same time, the delicate balance is that some folks don't want the teachers to tell them what to do with their child, you know. And so that's that balance you're going to have to walk, and I don't think there's any easy way around it. But if you are that concerned about the child, and certainly if you're concerned about the child's safety, I think it is worth doing that extra step and having that consultation. And then I don't know in terms of how it works within your school, who you go to when you worry, what keeps you, you know, awake, when do you talk to your principal, is the nurse, or how you handle that piece. But certainly it's not easy, and that we're trying to bridge that gap. So, yeah.
I just wanted to add something because my eyes lit up when you said Council Bluffs Schools, because that's my area. They do have a resource navigator. I don't know if they've told you about that, but they work with all of the schools in Council Bluffs, and their goal is to work with children and their families and get them connected to the appropriate resources depending on what's going on with them. Omaha and certain schools are lucky to have people such as Mary Kate here that are located in their schools and therapists in which they can go during class time and go meet with a therapist. Council Bluffs, not so much. So creating a good rapport, a good relationship with those students and getting as much information as possible. And then if it's outside of what you can do in your scope, maybe getting a hold of that resource navigator and then they can take it from there.
Okay, we have another question up front.
Well, actually, I just wanted to say something. I don't know if everybody's aware of this, but in the state of Nebraska, they passed a legislative bill this spring requiring suicide awareness training for all school personnel starting in 2015, I believe is what it was. Senator Amanda McGill was one of the state legislatures or sponsors that did that, so...
Thank you for letting us know about that.
Well, I mean, because it brought up, I just thought I would point that out.
Be interesting if Iowa legislates that as well. I know in Nebraska, a number of parents were fighting really hard for that to happen, and boy, that's taken a while. So I don't know if Iowa legislates that or not. Do you know, Sierra?
No, it hasn't been mandated yet, so it's not. And Iowa's usually a little more ahead of the game with those type of things, but not currently.
They're making leaps and bounds in Iowa. Sierra and I are both on the advocacy for the state, and so it's something that they've made great strides, especially this year. But there's more to be made, and I think they're headed in the right direction, and I think they've got enough of the louder mouths out there now.
Okay, we've got a couple questions up here.
I have a question about veteran suicide. Through social media, we've learned that veterans are killing themselves at a rate of 22 a day. And I tend to believe that, even though it's on social media, because every time I go to the VA to see my primary care physician, part of the pre-physician meeting screening includes questions to find out if I'm having mental health problems. But I don't know what to make of that figure. How does that compare to the population as a whole? is that a figure that is disproportionate to the representation of veterans in the general population? Have there been studies that look at specialized groups of people and isolate a correlation between membership in that group and the risk of suicide?
I don't want to speak out of turn, but I think that we've always known that suicide incidence rates are high for young people. It's one of the most common causes of death for young people, and it's increasingly a cause of death among the elderly. I think in the news reports I've read, there's definitely something going on with veterans at a higher rate than we've seen in the past, but I couldn't speak intelligently about that. Have any of you, can you talk to the veteran issue?
Well, two things. I don't know what the exact number is offhand, but it's way too high. And, we certainly, at UNMC, we're fairly close to Offutt Air Force Base, and also we rotate at the VA, and so there's a lot of training collaborations. And certainly where I trained in Ann Arbor, Michigan, we had a very close relationship with the VA. You know, it's a complex issue as to why it's happening so often and why we cannot get control of it, so to speak. And I think part of it is certainly a workforce issue, and then there's not enough folks. And I know the Veterans Affairs Department has tried to trying to hire a lot of folks that are well-skilled in treating mental illness, whether that's social workers or therapists or psychiatrists, and it's a constant shortage. But I, from folks that I've talked to, there's also a tremendous stigma about seeking help. And for folks that are active duty, sometimes they talk about, well, it's sort of like literally having career suicide if you're going to go seek help and admit to some of these things. And I think that larger cultural issue, if we are to make any headway, that's going to require a lot of courage. And I don't have any easy solution to that either. And clearly, we have been failing, I think, the veterans in this area. With any sort of public awareness campaign, it's going to require people to step forward, as Mindy has, and to say, I have been a very decorated veteran, but this is what I struggle with every day. I remember recently reading an article about the high incidence of PTSD among special forces veterans, and again, how sometimes it's the culture makes it difficult to talk about, and so then folks will self-medicate. And in fact, when I chose a career in psychiatry, I wasn't intending to as my last rotation, but I was rotating at the VA in a substance abuse treatment unit, and I remember talking to a former Army Ranger, and he talked about after suffering a career-ending back injury, how it kind of snuffed his sense of purpose, and then trying to work with him closely to find what that was going to be afterwards was what really inspired me to go into the field. And I do think that's going to require folks that are veterans to speak up about it. I think it's going to require a lot more openness, and I think it's going to require the hardest thing of all, which is cultural change, where it's okay if people are hurting to seek treatment, even if it's not a physical injury. And I think until some of those elements change, it's going to be difficult for us to change that rate. And so I think that's kind of where things are at.
And our middle surviving son is an Afghanistan PTSD sufferer. He saw serious duty over there and wasn't even back a whole year, I don't think, when Cameron was lost. And I really think that we guard ourselves very cautiously over him because he's the resilient one. He's the one that's, he's constantly saying, I'm fine. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to this. We just got to get on with life and go on. And I hear all that Army stuff in him. And be it military or otherwise, I have the utmost respect for the jobs they're doing. Don't get me wrong. But I really think that those individuals need to be followed up with more carefully, more cautiously. I myself 20 plus years ago when the boys were little, had a tenant that I managed an apartment complex that I had to identify by his own suicide, and he was a Vietnam vet. So, I mean, it's stuff that obviously resonates with these individuals, but I think the mental health check, just like in our schools and with the young kids and everyone, I think it's very important that we follow up on the education with them all, because the physical health is not the only thing to follow up on. The mental health needs to go hand in hand with the physical health all the way along. I mean, I say the same thing with the high school and junior high kids. You know, we're real happy to teach our kids about sex, but are we going to teach them about mental health? Come on.
We have a question up here.
Yeah. Sierra, I'm specifically asking this question to you.
Okay.
I have a family member who has attempted suicide numerous times, and I'm just kind of at the point where I don't know what else to say or do, and I just don't know if you might have maybe 3 or 4 of your top recommendations of what to do or how to deal with it. I mean, there is suicide in our family on both sides. I've had very close friends take their own lives. And he has attempted at least 4 or 5 times, never succeeded, will stay clean for a while and then goes right back to it. And I don't know exactly how to deal with it anymore. The last time he did it, I sent him a message and just said, I'm here. I love you no matter what. You can say whatever you need to say to me. And he's never even responded to that message. And he only calls when he's really drunk.
Right.
And we've already been really clear about, we're not having conversations with you when you're in that place. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you have any recommendations, any way to approach the situation in your experience, what you've seen has been maybe successful. Not a stranger to this, but right. This is really kind of at a point where I just feel completely helpless.
Right. That's a complex question, and I'm sorry that you have to endure all of this. Family dynamics are complicated when someone is struggling with depression and suicidal ideation. You have the people that are always there, always supportive, and then they're called the enablers. And then you have the people who are fed up and have given up and shut down and are angry. Sounds like to me he maybe has some substance abuse issues, which makes it even more complicated. I think that message that you sent probably meant more to him than you'll ever realize. Even though it wasn't validated, I bet you it meant so much. In my struggle, I had family members who wouldn't see me in the hospital because they were so angry. And I'm talking my mother, my sister, and my brother. I only had 2 people that would come and see me in the hospital, and that was my stepfather and my nephew. I still remember that to this day, and I hold that dearly to my heart. And if it wasn't for them being a part of my recovery process, I have no idea how I would have made it through. So by saying, I know this sucks, I know you're in pain, I don't know what to do, but I'm here, is more profound than you'll ever realize. Sounds like he really needs to seek treatment. Obviously, you know that. He probably knows that. But the substance abuse makes it worse. When I was struggling, I self-medicated with alcohol, and I was intoxicated probably first 2 years of my college career. But that just makes it worse. But once I had my wake-up call, I had to get the booze out of the picture before I could ever work on myself. So it's just something that is a complicated treatment question that he needs maybe people to help him get that treatment. And that's easier said than done. But keep on supporting him. I'm not saying enable him. That's different.
but saying, hey, I get it. This sucks. This is awful. But I'm here and I love you. I care about you and I care about your life.
On that note, what advice might Dr. Liu and Mindy, might you have for others? I'm sure a lot of people in the audience have friends or family who are struggling and you're feeling flooded. Maybe you don't want to hear one more word about this. Maybe this is really hard on you. And so what suggestions do you have? Maybe Mindy, what outlets, in addition to church, have you found have helped you not forget your pain, but at least have a place to put it?
As a survivor, there is nowhere to put it. You just kind of have to take it and go on with it. There's good days and there's bad days, and those little creepy thoughts even get into my head. And it's, you know, there is no amount of words that anybody can say sometimes to keep you going, but I'll tell you what, the faces that you see and the hugs that you get, those are the ones you remember. I can't tell you any words that a lot of people have said to me. The words don't impress upon me, but the faces that were there for me have been there for me on those days, or the short little notes that somebody has sent me in support and said, you know, just because it's been so long, whatever length of time it's been for someone, it still is there. It's never going away. It's a part of my life. It's a part of who I am. It's a part of who my husband is and my children and his Cameron's nieces and nephews. And that's just the way it is. And all we can do is hope for a better tomorrow and hope that we can alleviate the pain and get educate people about alleviating the pain and getting rid of it.
Do we have time for one more question, or do we?
We do. Does anybody have a final thought or comment to share? Looks like it's you, Erin, which I failed to mention. Erin Grace, we're really lucky that she's here tonight. She's a columnist with the World Herald, and thank you. We didn't get to say thank you to you for being here to moderate the conversation, so thank you. Thank you to all of you for sharing, but...
Well, thank you all for joining us. I really appreciate it. We'll all be hanging around afterwards. If there's something you didn't want to ask, you know, come holler. And hope everyone has a beautiful night.
And we have one final more? Thought. Okay.
You know, this viewing may have brought up something for many of you, and there are support groups. Find someone. If this is bringing up some things that you need some help, find someone. Find someone to help you work through this, because sometimes just watching these kinds of things can trigger a lot of emotions that you may be having. Mm-hmm. So take good care of yourself.
Yeah. That's a lovely note to end.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2013 documentary film Running from Crazy, directed by Barbara Koppel. This program, presented in collaboration with the Kim Foundation, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, October 7, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The members of the panel have been Howard Liu, an educator and child psychiatrist at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and director of faculty development programs at UNMC, Mindy Eggert, the mother of Cameron Molitor, lost to suicide 2 years ago, and Ciara Warden, a licensed independent social worker in the state of Iowa and a full-time faculty member at the University of Nebraska at Omaha's School of Social Work. The moderator was Erin Grace, a columnist with the Omaha World Herald. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Patrick Kinney, Molly Welch, Brooke Masick, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.